the show today. And it's just incredible. Like, obviously I'm one of the parties to this whole ongoing feud. So of course it's difficult. Oh wait, let me click record. I do in fact want to preserve this for posterity. Anyway, I was apologizing for not having shaved, and I was talking about Mark Levin speaking badly of Jack Hunter and of me today on his radio program. And obviously, since I'm involved in this feud, and those of you who don't know what's going on, you can check out TomWoods.com and look at the most recent blog post. It'll bring you up to date on what's going on. But obviously, given that I'm a party to this, I know you don't look to me to be impartial in it. But still, even given that, there is no way, I don't see how there's any way he can look at what just happened and think he came out the winner. And yet he goes on the radio, and I didn't hear it, but is obviously talking as if he won. How did he win? I beat him all over the computer screen, and he refuses to debate, and if you propose a debate, you get banned from his Facebook page. If you even propose a debate, no matter how politely... Oh, my goodness gracious. Man, oh, man. This is something else. Slavery. All right. We're recording. We're recording. All right. Well, thanks. Thanks. That was really something today. Okay. And in a way, I mean, it is actually the stuff that I'm talking about in that exchange is basically taken from... the early republic, sure, but I'm also talking about the Constitutional Convention and the ratification of the Constitution, so that does fall within the parameters of this course. So it wouldn't be entirely wrong of me of us to discuss this at some point, but let's get to the material at hand here. We'll have another quiz this week, and what I've decided to do, because I'm such a softie, and also because I understand other people do it this way, is I'm going to give you guys more time on the quizzes. So I'll have the questions posted, as I did last time. I'll have them posted by the end of the day tomorrow. I haven't made them up yet, so just depends on how quickly I can do that. So I'll have those up by the end of the day, and then the quiz will open on Friday, and then basically I'll give you a week. I'll give you a week with the quiz. So that people have been saying that the weekend doesn't really work, it's not so good, and I mean, who wants to be working on this quiz on the weekend? So that's what my new shtick is. Okay, let's see, what else is going on here? All right, what else do I want to say? All right, so that's the thing with the quizzes. Okay, now, just a little bit of apology from the beginning. Of the 8 weeks that we have to go, that we're going through, this is the hardest one we have to do. I find it the least stimulating of all the material we have to cover. Like I've left all the boring colonies for now. So unfortunately, it's not the most gripping in the world. I mean, if Rothbard were here, he could make, he could make this Clementine gripping. But you know, it is what it is. We're stuck with it. But the next few weeks are going to be, I think, quite interesting. We've got, the real meat of the stuff. Now it all really comes together. Okay, here we go. Oh, okay, wait, before I go on to Georgia. Georgia is the last of the 13 colonies. And by the time we're done today, we will have covered all 13. But Georgia is the last of the 13. Georgia was established in 1732. So you may wonder, why am I putting Georgia first? And the answer is because I did the Georgia slides first. And then when I finished, it just seemed like such an ordeal to switch the order around, and it was taking forever and freezing up. All right, so we're going out of order. Throw us in jail. All right, we're going to go out of order. I didn't put anything, just so I remember right now, I didn't put anything in these slides about Delaware. But if you read about Delaware, you know that its history as an English colony is not very significant in the sense that it really amounted to the southern counties of Pennsylvania. And in the early 1700s, it became a real full-fledged colony in its own right. So that's really all we need to know about Delaware. Okay, here we go. Okay, so I'm going to start with Georgia. Now, as I said in the past, when we talk about colonial America, nobody thinks Georgia. Everybody thinks colonial Massachusetts, just because of the Massachusetts-centric nature of our history. Massachusetts was not the first of the settlements, as we know. That was the first of the permanent settlements was Jamestown in 1607. But for some reason, we think colonial. We think, you know, Puritan, you know, funny hats and shoes and whatever. But Georgia is indeed one of the original 13 colonies. And what I've done here is I've listed the primary motivations behind the settlement of Georgia. So three basic things. First, to provide a barrier against invasion of the other English colonies by Spanish, French, or Indian forces. There was a philanthropic motivation to give the destitute in England the chance for a better life. And these could be people who were imprisoned. These could be people who were just down in their luck or unemployed or without a home or whatever. And we'll give them a new shot. You know, we'll send them to Georgia and, you know, start them with a new life. And enrich the mother country by producing certain things. And as we'll see in the next slide, silk in particular was the product that the trustees of Georgia were hoping to see produced. Because if you look at the amount, it was like 500,000 pounds per year. It may have been more than that. I can't remember the exact figure. It was an enormous amount of money the British were spending on imported silk from other countries. And they thought if we had our own source of silk, that would be better. Okay, so the little article you read this week from the Freeman actually is really good about called the Planned Economy in Georgia. That's the only, I think, non-boring thing you had to read this week. I'm sorry that's the way it is. But James Oglethorpe, a prominent member of Parliament, was really the guy who got the ball rolling with the settlement in Georgia. So a group of 21 trustees governed this colony, and it was established in the charter that none of them could reap any profit from it. So that reflected the fact that this was a purely philanthropic enterprise. It was entirely centered on helping others. And the way it was set up was that they would run the colony for 21 years, after which it would revert to the crown. Well, as it turned out, they ran it for 20 years, and it reverted to the crown in 1752. They would have religious freedom for everyone other than Catholics. And here, it wasn't even so much out of some kind of philosophical conviction, but rather that, you know, we need bodies. If this colony is going to serve the purpose we want it to, particularly as a military buffer, we need people to be there. And so we can't insist on religious uniformity. That's just going to interfere with the ability to recruit people to settle in Georgia. And finally, Georgia, up until much later, Georgia became the only colony in which the citizens had no representative institution of any kind. The trustees, these 21 people, they more or less ran the colony. Now that, let me just see if I can't remember if I actually explained this in the slide or not. If I didn't, I'll explain it to you verbally. I didn't. All right. So in case this just seems obnoxious, I will try to explain what the rationale was or what the justification was. How could they justify having no representative body? And basically the answer was, we're not going to have taxes in Georgia because all the various expenses that governments would normally levy taxes for, the trustees are going to put up out of their own money. Philanthropists are going to put up out of their own money. And back in England, the government will make occasional subsidies of the colony as well. So there's no need for taxes. So if there's no need for taxes, then that means there's much less need, at least in the minds of the trustees, to have a representative assembly. Because 90% of the reason to have a representative assembly is to consent to taxation. But we have no taxation, so there's nothing to consent to, so they thought. So no assembly. And moreover, the thinking seems to have been, look, you people ought to be grateful you're not languishing in jail or, you know, unemployed and destitute back in England. You ought to be thankful you're here instead of griping about some representative assembly. So what is going to happen is that Georgia will be, as the article you read suggests, is going to be a highly let's say, paternalistic sort of colony. The trustees are going to exercise powers that are aimed at sort of uplifting the whole man, right? His well-being in all ways. We want to make sure that he's sober and industrious, and so we're going to whip him into shape. The article that you read, by the way, is based heavily on Daniel Boorstin's book, and now I can't think of what it's called. I'll think of it later. Daniel Boorstin, who, I mean, he's not always right, but in his stuff on colonial America, he's got really good. He's a good storyteller. He's got good anecdotal stuff, and his stuff on Georgia is just killer. And Rothbard has a good chapter on Georgia too, but I was trying to minimize your reading this week. Okay, so the trustees are trying to impose rules on this colony without really knowing the things you would sort of need to know for it to work. So in other words, they don't know, never having been to Georgia, they don't know how many acres would a person have to own in order to produce enough goods, the sale of which would make possible survival, subsistence. Like, how do they know? How do they know what products are suited to the conditions of Georgia? Well, of course they don't. So this is a bit of a problem, but they're going to act, they're groping in the dark, but they're going to act as if they have the kind of knowledge that they clearly lack. And so it's supposed to serve as a military buffer zone, as I said. So the people of Georgia have to be sober and industrious, and the land holdings have to be small. The reason the land holdings would have to be small is that if you have one person, he owns a huge amount of land, like some, you know, like hundreds and hundreds of acres. The problem with that is that would be like a large hole in the buffer. So what you want is a bunch of small plots with people on each one rather than giant plots that are sparsely populated. So the small became. We want them to be sober and upright so that they will be alert and ready in case it's necessary to protect the colony. And what else do we want to say about this? They also don't want large land holdings because they're afraid that people will then turn to various forms of forced labor to get their work done. And the thinking is, no, we don't want people to become lazy, relying on others for labor. We want everybody to be working because that will encourage the kind of robust strain of colonists that the strategic importance of this colony demands. The land that you get in Georgia, people were by and large getting 50-acre plots, could not be sold. This was to prevent people from ever leaving, because you can't sell your land and take the proceeds and leave, so that makes you want to stay, or to speculate in real estate. You can't sell the land, so you can't speculate in land. And the land had to be handed on to a male heir. If your male heir was not interested in continuing to live in Georgia, or if you had no male heir, the land then reverted to the trustees. So you could not reap anything from that land. Okay. All right, so I just said this. Each family receives 50 acres. Key product that they're trying for anyway is silk. The problem is they're not really going on reliable information when they suggest to the settlers that silk is really the way to go. Legend had it that mulberry trees grew in abundance in Georgia. And now again, there should be a blank line, which I did indeed insert in the original slide. But unfortunately for the promoters, it was the black rather than the white mulberry that grew so well in Georgia. And the black mulberry had leaves that were too harsh for silkworms to flourish. So silk production never really got off the ground. But nevertheless, the trustees, they just knew this was the thing to produce. We can't let these layabouts, which is a Montgomery Burns word, decide what to produce. It's going to be silk. So landowners are required to plant at least 50 white mulberry trees on their 50 acres. And later, when a representative assembly is gradually introduced, if you want to serve in the assembly, you have to have at least 100 mulberry trees planted. I mean, they are dead serious about the silk production. And it really becomes a kind of a... okay, so this is what I talked about. Okay. So the trustees in the British government contributed funds to the Georgia colony, no taxes levy, no need for a representative body. Okay, so all these things I already said. But Georgia's climate proves inhospitable to raising silkworms, as I said. So this philanthropic experiment really ends in failure. I mean, people are frustrated. Gradually, they have to make concessions to people. So the prohibition on drink goes away. The limitation on landholding goes away. You can have up 2,000 acres if you want. All these sorts of things begin to wither away. And eventually, it's once the more or less the trustees more or less give up and it reverts to the crown, and a lot of these restrictions are lifted and people can decide what they want to produce, and a lot of them produce rice and other things, then it really starts to take off. Like, you know, once you release the shackles, then actually you do attract a lot more people and becomes more prosperous. But it is a comedy of errors, all the things they try to do to force these poor souls to grow mulberry trees. It's just in utter defiance of all the evidence to the contrary. This is clearly not going to work. They just push on all the harder. I mean, it really is like an utterly bizarre example of central planning. So it's a, you know, there's a great lesson for us here in our own colonial past. Okay, so let's say something now about New York. I assigned a section from Rothbard here. Again, I mean, you notice how incredibly detailed and almost overwhelming this stuff is. And that talked about the Dutch settlement in what later became New York, but was called New Netherland, with the capital at New Amsterdam. And that basically lays the groundwork for the Dutch settlement. And now I want to pick up, just so as not to duplicate effort, from the point at which the British take over. And that basically takes place in the 1660s and 1670s. King Charles II grants his brother James, who's the Duke of York, all the territory between the Connecticut and Delaware rivers. Well, easy for him to say, but the Dutch are already there. They claim this area. So this inevitably brings these two colonial powers into conflict with one another. So in 1664, Richard Nichols, commanding the English Navy, wins a surrender from the Dutch governor, Peter Stuyvesant. And this is brought about basically bloodlessly. In spite of Stuyvesant's efforts to rally the population of New York in support of his rule, by and large, most people accepted the prospect of English rule really with great equanimity. I mean, their view was that Stuyvesant and the Dutch hadn't done a particularly noteworthy job in governing the place, so it didn't seem like it was any big deal that they would substitute one ruler for another. So this was carried out really without firing a shot. Well, the Dutch briefly reconquer what they called New Netherland in 1673, but the English retake it in 1674, and then they hold on to it permanently. And at that point, the Duke of York obviously renames it New York. It is ethnically quite diverse. It's got French and Germans and Scandinavians and various Indian tribes, as well as numerous Africans whom the Dutch had brought over as slaves. And in part because the Duke of York, James, granted some of his political supporters large tracts of land, a class of large landowners developed in New York. Political power was exercised by, again, the sort of a typical form where you have a governor, a council, and a representative body. So we have a governor and a council. The assembly in this case takes about a decade or so to take shape. And then finally, you do indeed have a representative assembly in New York. And religious toleration is observed. James himself was a Catholic, but did not attempt to impose this on the settlers. So this is one of the what we call the middle colonies. Now, in tandem with New York, we naturally want to talk about New Jersey. Now, I remember I used to teach history to college kids, and years ago, like in another lifetime, it seems like. And New Jersey, every time we had to talk about colonial New Jersey, I walked in and dreaded it. If you really should look through, and Floy Lilly is here in the room, she can attest to this. If you try to follow the history of colonial New Jersey, it will make your head explode. So you notice I did not assign the Rothbard material, because he is indeed, because there is a lot of very interesting stuff and anti-government stuff, and, you know, fascinating going on, but it is so complicated that I have spared you this, and I'm distilling New Jersey. I used to actually say to my students, the less we say about New Jersey, the better. And of course, I taught on Long Island, so that was their attitude anyway. You know, the less we say about New Jersey, the better. So they were willing to go along with that. Colonial New Jersey or modern. Oh, that's just a joke. I have many fond memories of New Jersey. I spent, when I was in grad school, I spent every summer at Point Pleasant and Bayhead at the beach, at the Cove Point Motel with my friends. And one of these days, we're going to sort of have a reunion. I'll go back there. So, and I saw many a concert at the PNC Bank Center. But anyway, we talk about that during the question session. Okay, so what I put here is extremely complicated history with victory of this or that faction leading to ongoing changes in government. So not long after receiving his charter to New York, James, the Duke of York, gives a large part of the southern part of his territory to a couple of political allies of his, Sir John Berkeley and Sir John Carteret. This became New Jersey. Okay, so one of them, well, Berkeley, sells his half interest because it's not really turning a profit, and he more or less figures he's going to cut his losses and just say, heck with it, go do something else. But in selling his half interest, well, this splits the colony in half, and that's why you get East Jersey and West Jersey for a while. And the stories of East and West Jersey, oh my gosh, I'm telling you, you got to read this. You'll understand what I'm saying. But to make a long story short, the two halves eventually join in 1702 to give us the New Jersey that we know and love today. And it's similar to New York and different from New York. It's similar in the religious and ethnic diversity. There are a lot of Quakers in New Jersey, but unlike New York, lacked a class of large landowners. They were much smaller. The Carolinas. Now, initially, this begins as one rather than two places. So in the 1660s, Charles II grants what becomes known as Carolina to eight proprietors. Now, they name it Carolina, and that's because the Latin name for Charles is Carolus. So that's by the way, why, Charlemagne comes from that, this is basically they're naming it after him, and that's not an unwise move on their part. But there comes into existence a kind of a natural differentiation between the northern and southern regions of Carolina. And so I quote here from Alan Brinkley, who was my PhD advisor, a good guy in his own way. But he says, the northern settlers were mainly backwoods farmers. In the south, fertile lands and the good harbor at Charlestown, which later becomes Charleston, promoted a more prosperous economy and a more stratified aristocratic society. And these two settlements were eventually divided into North and South Carolina in 1729. Okay, now for the rest of what we're going to talk about, I want to focus on some issues that were kind of colony-wide, or that were intercolonial in nature, sort of common experiences that the colonies had. And the first of these is the British regulation of colonial trade. And here we have to make some distinction. It's true that the regulations we're about to look at were widely evaded by the colonists. There were smuggling and lack of compliance with British rules and so on and so forth. That's true. But by and large, as time went on, the colonies more or less came, at least officially anyway, if not always in practice, to accept the idea that Britain could regulate the trade of her empire. She could put restrictions on it, and these would be allegedly for the good of the whole. And in exchange for these regulations, the colonies enjoyed the military defense umbrella that the British Empire afforded. Now, this distinction will become important in a couple of weeks, because what we'll see is that, in other words, right now the colonists, although in practice they smuggle and they evade these rules, in theory they accept them. In the 18th century, going down into the 1760s, we're going to find that the colonies are not accepting some of the new things that the British are doing to them. And we're going to see there are differences between the things the British start doing in the 1760s and the things that they're doing right now. A lot of colonists drew in their minds a distinction between the external regulation of the trade of the whole empire, which properly belonged to the powers of Parliament, on the one hand, and the internal regulation of the affairs of the colonies on the other, including taxation. That was a separate matter. And that, the colonies believed that by right of tradition and long-standing practice, they had, in effect, worked out a right to govern themselves when it came to internal matters. But external matters, by and large, you know, in spite of the fact that in practice they evaded it, in theory, they more or less accepted it. So the British had for a long time had a commercial rivalry with the Dutch, and one of the ways they're going to deal with that is in the 1650s we've got laws to keep Dutch ships out of the English colonies. So any shipping that's going to take place is going to have to be, the stuff is going to have to be loaded onto an English ship to encourage the English shipping industry. In 1660, we get the regulation that the colonies are closed to all trade except that carried by English ships. Tobacco and certain other items are to be shipped only to England or her possessions. 1663, all goods sent from Europe to the colonies must pass through England first, where they would be subject to English taxation. These collectively are referred to as the Navigation Acts. And in 1673, customs officials were appointed to enforce the Navigation Acts. And as I say, these went widely evaded, and the colonists sort of built up kind of a tradition as smugglers, so that in the 18th century they would be able to revive that. And in the 19th century, during starting in 1807 and then continuing during the War of 1812, there were a lot of New Englanders who managed to evade various restrictions on their trade, harking back to this tradition of smuggling that they had developed. So, all right, so the Navigation Acts are part of the landscape of the imperial structure. Now, in particular, the New England colonies were notoriously lax in abiding by the Navigation Acts. And with the passage of time, the government back home grew impatient with this and ultimately believed that the colonies needed to be punished for their inability or refusal to abide by these perfectly legitimate regulations. And that was their view. They were perfectly legitimate. And the main form that this punishment took was the establishment of something called the Dominion of New England. And the colonial revulsion in the face of the Dominion of New England provides us an excellent example of the colony's commitment to the principles of local self-government. They believe that, you know, they have the right, they have their own colonial assemblies, and they make their own laws, and they govern themselves. And this they consider to be an absolutely outrageous and intolerable infringement on these traditional liberties. So what is this thing? Well, this short-lived Dominion of New England, as you can see, late 1680s, combined the government of Massachusetts with also the rest of the New England colonies. But although the name Dominion of New England might lead you to think that these are just the New England colonies, it also included New York and New Jersey. And at the time it was dissolved, it had designs on Pennsylvania and perhaps even other areas as well. And basically it consisted of this. It closed down all the colonial assemblies, and all the various colonial governments were amalgamated into a single structure with one royal governor appointed to rule over all this territory. I'm going to move my chair up a little bit. Ah, there we go. Okay. Yeah, that's better. I have it low because it's good for my posture. It makes me kind of look up at the screen instead of down like this is bad for you. All right, anyway, so the best-known governor is Sir Edmund Andros, who had performed various governmental services throughout, particularly in New York, for years. But now he's named the governor of the head of the Dominion of New England. And now, under the best of circumstances, this would have been difficult to enforce because, as I say, the colonies had grown accustomed to their own having their own legislatures and being self-governed. But these were not the best of circumstances because Andros had such a tin ear when it came to in recognizing that he's got a tinderbox on his hands, and he is not moving, especially gingerly, let's put it that way, in dealing with the colonists. So he's just levying taxes just on his own say-so, and that, from the colonial point of view, this is just flies in the face of very, very long-standing British tradition. If you protest this, he throws you in jail. And naturally, then, the colonists are just waiting for their opportunity to strike. And that opportunity comes in 1688 with the Glorious Revolution. The Glorious Revolution involves the replacement of King James. I think I may have even talked about this in another earlier talk. The replacement of James II, the Catholic James II, with William and Mary. And it's called the Glorious Revolution because it occurred more or less bloodlessly. James fled, and that was the end of it. Well, what's the connection between this and the colonies? Well, first of all, it takes a long time in those days for news to reach the colonies. I think it wasn't until maybe April of 1689 that they learned that this had even happened. But it occurred to them that, okay, the monarch who authorized the mission of Andros to come over here and lord it over us as the head of the Dominion of New England, that monarch has now been deposed. So perhaps now is the opportunity we've been waiting for to stop this structure in its tracks, present this new king with a fait accompli, and say, hey, look, we got your Dominion of New England governor over here in jail. You know, now what? Now what would you like us to do? And sort of figuring that perhaps he'll have, you know, other fish to fry and may simply recall Andros and we'll just put an end to this nightmarish scenario once and for all. So that's what they decided to do. They figured the sugar daddy who had put Andros in this position was no more, so maybe now's the time to smack the guy down. Okay. This is actually from the Daniel Boorstin book, whose title completely escapes me. But I like this little passage. On April 4th, 1689, I was right, okay, word reached Boston that the new king and queen wanted, quote, all magistrates who have been unjustly turned out to resume their former employment. Well, this is a reference to the way in which the Dominion of New England had just cleared out so many office holders that who had occupied the colonial governments prior to the creation of the Dominion. So that was all the citizenry needed to hear. Maybe I'm quoting myself. Yeah, I'm quoting myself, actually. That's what I'm doing here. This is from an essay I wrote in the year 2000, and I'm quoting Daniel Boorstin. All right, that's what's going on here. Okay, so here's my quotation from Daniel Boorstin. The machine-like precision with which this parallel revolution unrolled points to careful plans and leadership, which no one has yet unearthed, writes historian Daniel Boorstin. The townspeople rose. The countryside rose. Andros and some of his principal counselors were thrown into jail. And he had, by the way, he had tried to flee, apparently dressed in women's clothing. This is not a very dignified way to be found, but so he was. A meeting presided over by the last governor under the Bay Colony Charter, so just prior to the establishment of the Dominion, adopted the Declaration. Oh, hold on. I'm seeing froze here, so let's see. Is it going to happen? Oh, back? Okay. A meeting presided over by the last governor under the Bay Colony Charter adopted the Declaration of the Gentlemen, Merchants, and Inhabitants that had been drawn up by the eminent Puritan divine Cotton Mather, The Dominion was at an end, and self-rule was again in effect. Okay. And so I have used this in my Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. I give three examples of how, and this is sort of using an archaic sense of the term jealous, but how jealous the colonies were of their powers of self-government. They did not want to give them up. So when a confederation, and in fact it wasn't really a confederation, was it? Because it really was a kind of an amalgamation, this Dominion of New England. When that was imposed on them, they fought against it. When in the 1640s and 1650s, a confederation of New England was entered into voluntarily by various New England colonies as a joint, as a mechanism for joint operation against the Indians, I pointed out that Massachusetts later insisted on a veto power over the decisions of that body because they were afraid it would be dragged into offensive wars that it wanted no part of. So again, they want to preserve their ability to make their own decisions for their own people. And then in the 1750s, Benjamin Franklin will propose something called the Albany Plan of Union to try to create again an intercolonial alliance, an intercolonial structure, and this gets no support whatsoever. So this really is the theme, is the emphasis on self-government. And when we understand this, then we understand better later on with the Articles of Confederation why the insistence on preserving the freedom and independence of the colonies of the, then became states, of course, and likewise the various provisions in the Constitution that guaranteed the same sorts of things. Okay, all right, so finally, really the critical event that, you know, we can say involves, you know, a lot of more than one colony, basically, is that it involves the French and Indian War. And I'm basically breaking it down into three phases. Okay, let me get this map. This is really a terrible map. I should have a better one, but I don't. So I'm going to give you this. I'm going to put in the chat window. There we go. Okay. That's a really stupid map. I mean, it looks like some kid just scribbled it. But it's just to show you the French possessions. And you can see that, you know, France controls much of what today is Canada. And then you can see that to the west of the English settlements, you have a substantial amount of French settlement, and then you have a not quite a substantial amount of disputed area where both the French and the English could very easily come into conflict with one another. So this is indeed what begins to happen, is that the French and the English each sort of have the sense that the one or the other may be encroaching on them. And this ultimately winds up in a war. Now, let me just, if you don't mind, let me just skip ahead to, I want to skip ahead to this. So this slide should have gone first. So in the summer of 1754, the governor of Virginia sends George Washington, who was a colonel relatively inexperienced at this time, with a militia force into the Ohio Valley to act as a kind of a buffer against the possibility of French expansion. The Virginians unsuccessfully attack a French detachment and then find themselves under attack at their own Fort Necessity, which had been erected by Washington. Washington is forced to surrender. I think two-thirds of his men are wiped out. And it's this battle that, no, he certainly wasn't, and Floyd would know that having read all of Rothbard. This is what begins what's known as the French and Indian War. So the first phase of this war, which is set in motion by that initial battle, is really a local conflict confined to North America. And it's called the French and Indian War. It's very misleading. You know, it's one of these things you learn when you're in elementary school. It doesn't mean the French are fighting the Indians. It means they're fighting alongside the Indians. Everybody except the Iroquois really is on, in terms of Indians, are on the French side here. And the Iroquois are really more or less remaining passive during the war. So that's the first phase. The second phase is the phase in which this war becomes a world war. in which it spreads into Europe and India and the West Indies. And it's at this point that the British in the colonies really begin, the British government really begins to take full control of the war effort. And that actually consists also of forcibly enlisting colonists, seizing supplies, and requiring the colonists to quarter troops in their homes. So if you're wondering what was the origin of the Third Amendment, well, you know, you see perhaps some explanation. Now, incidentally, just so you know, I'll talk about that later. Okay, so third phase, 1758 till the end of the war, 1763, the British government begins to relax the measures that annoyed the colonists. They try to compensate people who had things taken from them. They discontinue some of these other practices. They decentralize a bit, and so on. And because by 1758, the colonists, many of them were just seething at the heavy-handedness in which the British were carrying out the war effort, and this was actually threatening the war effort itself. So finally, William Pitt sort of put an end to that, and the war begins to turn in England's favor. Well, for our purposes, the significance, really, of all this is as follows. 1763, the Treaty of Paris, the British are victorious. So England receives Canada and all French territory east of the Mississippi except New Orleans. So that's significant. Also significant is that up to now, the English colonies had really lived in fear of the French and therefore had needed England's support. This is no longer the case. They don't live in fear of the French any longer. And that obviously will have consequences. And then obviously the most significant consequence, as we'll see, is that the British go into substantial debt as a result of this, and they become desperate for revenue. They begin searching around for revenue, new sources of revenue, and they begin to look to their North American colonies for financial support. And their argument is that we're asking for a very relatively small amount of money, considering that, you know, we just protected you in this war, and we're providing you this very substantial defense umbrella. It seems like not much to ask for you to contribute a bit to your defense. And this is when we're going to begin to see the colonists making the kinds of constitutional distinctions that I kind of hinted at earlier. And they're going to begin to say the British are doing things that impinge on our powers internally, that don't restrict themselves simply to the regulation of trade, but deal with that override the decisions of our legislatures, that impose internal taxes on us without our consent, and so on. That's going to begin to take place right about now. And it's sort of interesting that so the British get into debt fighting a war, and the consequences of that are that they start to make demands of their colonies, which then leads to the American War for Independence, you know what, breaking loose that they had never anticipated. And in the same sort of interesting sort of way, the French then, during the American War for Independence, well, they make a substantial contribution to that. And then following that, they find themselves tremendously indebted. And it leads to a fiscal crisis, which leads to the calling of the Estates General in 1789 for the first time since 1614. And that leads to revolutionary consequences. War is just an unbelievably unpredictable phenomenon, as the 18th century amply demonstrated. Well, I want to finish today with a topic that's not on a slide, but I want to talk about it anyway. And that's, I want to sort of prep us for what's going to come next. Next week, we're going to be looking at some primary sources. We're going to be looking at some of the, and for next week's session, we'll have more real-time discussion. But next week we're going to be looking at some of the primary sources that people were reading at the time, philosophers, political philosophers who influenced people, and people who wrote at a popular level. And we're going to look at some of these influences on the colonists' thinking. And so that's an interesting topic. But after that, We're going to get back to where we're leaving off now. And when we get back to that, this is where we're going to be. We're going to be starting off in 1761. And in 1761, James Otis of Massachusetts is arguing against, he's making an advancing a legal argument against something called the writs, W-R-I-T-S, the writs of assistance. Now, the writs of assistance were general search warrants that could be, that were issued just on the slightest suspicion that you might be evading the Navigation Acts, you might be smuggling in, you know, let's say, Dutch molasses without paying the high tariff on it, or that sort of thing. And they could come invade your warehouse, your business, even your own home, looking for contraband. So the argument that Otis made was that this type of abuse, this is an abuse of the police power, that these general writs of assistance were granted without any of the safeguards that normally accompany the issuing of warrants, where there had to be you had to go to a judge and there had to be very substantial evidence that somebody is up to no good, and you know, all these formal processes, and none of this held when it came to the writs of assistance. And so they were subject to tremendous abuse. And now, of course, the colonists, a lot of them were guilty. It's another reason they were against them. Let's face it, they were against the writs of assistance. They were guilty. But there was this argument to be made that this is an abuse. And Otis argued, in fact, he even, I don't know if this is way before, it's before my time, might be before yours as well. Have you ever watched the show The Honeymooners from the 1950s? Ralph Cramden, Jackie Gleason, is always saying that a man's home is his castle. Well, James Otis actually says that exact thing in his speech, that a man's home is his castle, by which he means that, you know, the authority of the government, more or less, with only very, very unusual exceptions, stops at my door. So a man's home is his castle means we cannot tolerate this ability, this sort of just general search ability going unanswered. Now, we have some of the initial remarks that Otis delivered, and then the stenographer seems to have, it's kind of funny, that after a while it cuts off, and the stenographer then says, well, then Mr. Otis kind of said this and this and this, and I was just kind of feeling like, all right, can we just wrap this up? But basically, we can reproduce his argument well enough on the basis of what we have. Somebody's saying froze, so I'll just check. It doesn't look like it. I think I'm okay. I think I'm still okay. So anyway, what's the argument? What's the nature of the argument that Otis is making? He's making a constitutional argument. And when I say a constitutional argument, of course, I'm not referring to the U.S. Constitution because there is no such thing at that point. This is 1761. What constitution is he talking about? He's talking about the British Constitution. Now, the British Constitution, of course, is not a written document. It is a kind of a collection of documents and a collection of customary practices. There isn't any one thing you can point to and say, Article 7 says such and such. There is no Article 7. So what does it mean then in the British tradition to say that something is unconstitutional? What it means is to say that it is not traditional. It is a break with customary practice. That's what Otis is arguing. He is saying that the long-standing liberties of Englishmen are such that the British government does not have the right to invade them, that they have existed from time immemorial, and that gives them a sacrosanct character so that they cannot be invaded by the government. So that's Otis's argument, that the writs of assistance are unconstitutional because they break with long-standing tradition. That is the criterion for determining constitutionality. In the absence of a written constitution, tradition is the focal point. Now, the British government had gradually been moving toward a different view of what it meant for something to be constitutional. They more or less began to adopt what we might call a legal positivist point of view. Legal positivism is a teaching that argues that the validity of law comes not from its content, you know, whether that law is morally good or morally objectionable. But it comes merely from the will of the legislator. If the legislating body, whatever it happens to be, has decreed it, that's all we need to know. It is in force. The fact that the law has been passed. So, in other words, the law is not, you can't claim there's a higher law, you know, that I have to judge the laws of man by some higher law. No, there is no higher law. If you don't like the law, then you pass another one. But legal positivism is sort of like, I mean, the most familiar example of it would be your 5-year-old son wants to stay up. You say no. He says, why not? And you say, what do you say? What do you say? What do you say to your 5-year-old? Now, okay, I'm dealing with libertarians, so some of you are going to say, why, sure, of course you can stay up until 3 a.m., but let's just imagine, you know, you didn't have that philosophy. Because I said so. That is it. Because I said so. Either because I said so or because I'm the mom or I'm the dad. That's legal positivism. I don't have to give you a rationale. The fact that I've done it. So I don't have to, so from the British Parliament's point of view, I don't have to show you where in British tradition my action lies, where you can find it in tradition. I did it. We've passed it. If the Parliament enforces it, the Parliament passes it, that makes it constitutional. The will of the regime has been made clear. And there is no higher judgment. You can't stand in judgment of what the British Parliament has done. They've done it. That makes it constitutional. Now, I remember, by the way, my own mother did make this argument with me. Well, you know, it's because I said so, because I'm the mommy. And I was such a smart alecky kid. And I actually would go up to her and say, well, that's no kind of argument at all, Mom. I mean, and then that, you know, I was only making it worse. That didn't help me at all. I never won any concessions that way. But that's basically what, from the start, the colonies and the mother country are at loggerheads about, is the nature of the British Constitution. Is there some external constraint on the powers of Parliament, or is it essentially unlimited? Can it do whatever it wants to do? And the colonies thought that it was to be bound by tradition, and the British thought the colonists were just crazy. And so that's why, you know, I'm inclined to think that there is an inevitability about the conflict between the two sides, because that's more or less an irreconcilable couple of positions there. They're looking at the British Constitution totally differently. So you'll notice as the 1760s progress, and this is what we get into 2 weeks from now, there's a strain, and Rothbard, I think, is so anxious to emphasize the natural law aspect of the colonial resistance that he doesn't focus in on this quite so much, but there's a constant emphasis by the colonists that the British are engaged in terrible innovations. And they're using innovation as a pejorative term. I mean, we think innovation, we think, oh, like a new dishwasher or something. But for them, an innovation was a bad thing, because a good thing was tradition, their tradition of self-government. And they believed that because they had been enjoying self-government for so long, that itself had become part of tradition and could not be infringed upon. So that is the nature of the dispute. And so, as I say, in the 1760s, they will say, the British are now trying to do this to us, and this to us, and this to us, which they have never done before. They have not invaded the internal governance of these colonies before, and so therefore they are in violation of the British Constitution. So really the two sides are speaking different constitutional languages to each other. But this is, I think, this helps us to understand why the colonists, once they became free of the British, and they lived in states instead of colonies, why they were so anxious to draw up a written constitution. Because they thought, in this case, it's not going to be as easy for the government to weasel out of it as it is now. Because the British government can say, oh, it's constitutional because we say so. Well, what if we write the constitution down? Then if the government tries to do some crazy thing, we can point to something on paper and say, wait a minute, you're not allowed to do this. That's the reason they were so insistent on a written constitution, because they had seen the flaws of an unwritten one. Unfortunately, what they did not live to see, or perhaps fortunately for them, I suppose, unfortunately for us, was perhaps that it could well be, and here I go editorializing, that even a written constitution does not hold out the promise that they had for it, that perhaps Perhaps this institution is too difficult to control with any kind of constitution, written or otherwise. Okay, well, we're right up to our hour here at 8 p.m. Eastern, so we'll pause there. Yeah, see, yeah, I know. I see the sarcastic remarks. We'll pause there for a few minutes, and we'll do 10 minutes, and I'll come back, and we'll chit-chat about whatever related to this material, or whatever is not related to this material, whatever you want to talk about. So that'll be 10 minutes from now, and I'm gonna get my windows all ready for this, and then go out, and I'm going to tuck a couple of my kids in. Or I don't know if it's quite ready for their bedtime, but I'll say hello to them or something. Okay, let me just see. Okay. Opening a new window. There we go. It's a little bit slow here. Opening a window. Here we go. All right. Trying to open a window. No rush on the windows. Okay, let's see. Okay. Oh wow, good. Okay, these look interesting. Okay, now let me see. What can I subject you to musically? Ha ha ha. Now, of course, it's not ideal because I'm not using Pandora. I haven't figured that out. I don't have time to figure it out either. But so it's going to be, YouTube coming through my speakers and then into the speakers on the webcam. So we're talking about like. This is going to sound like they're performing in my trunk, but I'll try and find something. Let's see what I can find for you. Just don't. Gosh, I'm so uncreative these days. I can't think of it. Let's see. What do I want to subject you to? Oh, you would hate this, though. I don't want to make you miserable. It's August 25th, Kansas City. I'm going to see Steely Dan. It's one of the few non-progressive groups I would actually see. I like their arrangements and stuff. Let's see, a buffer zone of Georgia would benefit the colonies further north. Was this a singular idea of the 21, or were other interests involved? In other words, do you think these other colonies might have said, hey, it might be cool to have Georgia? I'm not sure how aware they were of it. And as it turns out, it wound up being a totally insignificant bust anyway, but I don't know of people really talking about the Georgia settlement much. Did the colonists think of this constitutionality as arising from anything in the past, like the Magna Carta, et cetera? Yeah, that would be an example. That would be an example. That would be one of the great... Now, I mean, at the time, of course, Magna Carta was much more limited in its significance, but it grew. It grew in significance over time, and its application grew wider and wider. And so, yes, they would argue that that's one of the things they're drawing upon in the history of English liberty when they evaluate government actions in the present. That's exactly what they would be doing. Okay, let me go back to the... this thing here. Yeah, now somebody's asking a question here, Mike Brewer, about Catholics. The exclusion of Catholics in Georgia as a buffer against Spain is echoed later in the campaign against JFK. Yeah, I guess the idea here is that we see this kind of weird suspicion of Catholics that runs through U.S. history. And yeah, that's true. I mean, I suspect, it's the main reason that people were hostile toward Catholics. I mean, some of it was theological, but really, I mean, by the time you get to the 18th century, I mean, most people really don't care that much that the Catholics have a different kind of worship than other people have, and, you know, whatever. But it was that the Catholics were perceived as having a loyalty other than or in addition to their sovereign. So, you know, you're loyal to the Pope. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean the Pope's greater than the King? Is this a potentially seditious group of people we have? And that seems to be basically the thing. And that persisted into the U.S., even into, I mean, Samuel Morse, who developed Morse code, was concerned that there was a plot, a popish plot afoot to populate the U.S. with Catholics. That when, you know, because you know that it was in the 1840s, 50s, that you start to see a lot of the Irish coming to the U.S., and those are mostly Catholic. And some Germans also in the 1850s were coming to the U.S., and some of them were Lutherans, but some were Catholic. And he had this theory, and he had a best-selling book on it, that this wasn't an accident, that all of a sudden these Catholics were coming. This was an attempt by the Pope to extinguish the light of liberty from America, from the fledgling land of the free. And then this persists into 1928 when Al Smith is running against Herbert Hoover, and it was argued that if Smith comes into power and becomes president, that he is going to bring the Pope, who at that time was Pius XI, he's going to bring him to the U.S. and install him as the president to rule over all of us. So jokingly, when Smith lost the election, he sent a one-word telegram to Pius XI, unpack. So don't bother coming. I didn't win. Okay. Oh, well, by 19th century standards, like 30,000 would be an astonishing seller. I think, let's see, what kind of seller? I mean, like Uncle Tom's Cabin was in the hundreds of thousands, so that was just, it's just absolutely incredible by 19th century standards. And there were a couple of other anti-slavery books that sold like 100,000. Just trying to think about them. But yeah, like in the 1830s and 40s, you can find a couple of other anti-slavery titles that sold that amount. But yeah, tens of thousands would have been pretty impressive then. Oh, popish is one of these words that was used by people who believed in these conspiracy theories and so on and on. Okay. As far as I know, in Georgia, nobody was bothered religiously. Okay. Oh, and yeah, and of course the Irish thing, yeah, did have something to do with the potato famine, right? So it may have been more than just some plot, right? Okay. I don't know how many Rollback has sold. I'm afraid to ask. I fear it's not very many, even though I think it's the best thing I've ever done, but I don't want to waste your time griping about that. Okay. Okay, but oh, thank you. I appreciate that. All right, anyway, well, let me get back to the submitted questions, and then we will we'll move on to any that you guys have. And just hold them, and then we'll do it. Okay, where's my other window here? Sorry, I've got so many things open because of the fight today. I got my website, I got Lou, I got the blog post thing for Lou. Yeah, okay. So let's see. All right. Okay, so the question is, let me refresh. What would the theme be? So if I had to pick a theme for this material, what would it be? The person's asking, would it be betrayal? I think you could. I mean, I think if you want to write like an overall history of the U.S., I think you would want to write it with certain themes in mind, picking themes. In other words, instead of just one thing after another, I would want to structure it and say, like, for example, I was talking to Gary North, and he said, he thinks an interesting way to talk about American history would be. Anyway, but he was saying Broken Covenants is an interesting theme. with like the Articles of Confederation just being chucked, or a lot of the Indian treaties being, the betrayals there. I think what Rothbard is kind of arguing it is, I think he finds good and bad, though. We could talk about Roger Williams, being a good guy, then turning around becoming a bad guy. Or you could talk about, the colonies fighting for freedom, and then maybe they wind up acceding to a political structure that's not going to yield them that in the long run. Things like that, you could make that argument. But on the other hand, there are so many struggles for freedom and against taxes and various forms of oppression that, maybe the story is that, there is, even if not a majority of the population, there is still that spark of liberty that runs through our history, even in difficult times. Rothbard was digging up tax revolts and all kinds of unsung heroes and forgotten heroic figures and so on. So I think you could put this through a lot of different lenses, in other words. Now I think somebody has submitted another couple of questions here. So let me go look at them. All right. Oh, good historical fiction at this time, that deals with this period. I actually don't know much about historical fiction that would cover this period, but does anybody know anything like that? Has anybody read any historical fiction from this period or that deals with this period? Oh, okay. So somebody just sent me a Skype message. Okay. Oh, that's funny. People's History. That's funny. Newt Gingrich. Yeah, I mean, I know that Gingrich, so-called co-authors books like that. So, I mean, those could be decent because I'm almost certain that he hasn't written a word of them. So whoever his co-author is might be sort of decent at this. Who knows? I don't know. Yeah, that's just not an area I know much about, I'm sorry to say. But I bet an astute Google search with the right phrases would yield you something. Okay. Let's see. Okay, I want to just sit back here for just 1 minute. Okay. Okay. So I think somebody is asking about, and I don't know if this is one of the submitted questions or it's in the back of my head, but somebody's asking about the triangular trade. So let me just call something up on that. Okay. Well, Wikipedia is as good as any, because this would be the best way to look at it. All right, so basically it works like this. I'm going to enter this. This is the key thing from the entire gigantic Wikipedia thing. Right there, just enter. Okay, so, all right, so you trade sugar from the Caribbean to Europe or New England, distill it into rum. Profits are used to purchase manufactured goods. Those are shipped to West Africa. That's where you get the slaves. Then the slaves are brought back to be sold to the sugar planters. The profits from the sale of the slaves are then used to buy more sugar, just ship to Europe, and then the thing just repeats. So that's what I mean by a triangular trade. But it's not a direct, I give you something, you give me something. It's a three-point thing. And this is pretty central to colonial commerce. Laura Ingalls Wilder. That's true. That's slightly later than where we are, but it wouldn't have been much different, in terms of lifestyle. Okay, let me just make sure let me get back to the questions that were submitted. I accidentally clicked on the Weather Channel widget on my desktop. Where Blackstone's commentary? Yeah, people had read Blackstone's commentaries. I mean, any lawyer would have to have read Blackstone's commentaries. So Otis would cite a source like that and believe that he was very much in line with the British tradition. In fact, let me see if I can get see what this. Oh, apparently, there is a person named Otis Blackstone. That's too bad. I was hoping I could do a shortcut search. But, let's see. I'm trying to get a distinct. Yeah, I'm trying to get a specific case of it. Okay, I'm calling something up right now. I just want to get it. I want to get something we can hang our hats on here. Okay. Okay, but all right. So everybody has read Blackstone's commentaries, but Blackstone himself, I mean, really, like anybody aspiring to be a lawyer has read them. But Blackstone himself, unfortunately, takes the view that Parliament is completely within its rights to insist on colonial submission in the case of. Well, whatever. I mean, it doesn't matter. It could be taxation, it could be whatever, but they have the right to compel the submission of the colonists. So that's where, just in that particular opinion, that's where obviously there's going to be dissent from the colonies. But they basically are nevertheless appealing to the same overall structure. I mean, they're all appealing to the same kind of documents and so on, but basically the complaint that somebody like Otis has and that others are going to have. John Adams, too. And I mean, John Adams, gosh, what is the word that he uses? I mean, maybe innovation. Well, he, too, by the mid-1760s, is offering the same complaint. But, yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to think this over here because... I mean, really what it boils down to is, from the point of view of somebody like Blackstone, he would have considered the colonies to be virtually represented. In fact, if we can get a quick thing on virtual representation, because they would all have agreed that, you know, all Englishmen are entitled to certain rights, and they're all entitled to not be taxed except by their own representatives. But then, so everybody agrees on that. That's a basic common structure for everybody. But the question is the specific application of these general principles to certain situations. That's where any dissent from Blackstone comes from. Yeah, okay, so here we go. Yeah, virtual representation. Yeah, I like that. The British argument was that, look, Don't give me that there's a constitutional argument against being taxed without your consent, without representation, that you don't have representation in Parliament. The British response was, look, I mean, almost nobody in Britain can vote, right? Almost nobody in England proper, let's say, can actually vote. I mean, like 3% of the men can vote. So, you know, the English argument was, are you going to say that 97% of Englishmen are also not represented? No, you are all represented, because the people who go to, act as your representatives, they represent all the people. They're not just representing the small minority that vote for them. They represent everybody. They've got everybody's interests at heart. Well, you know, from the colonial point of view, is this virtual representation concept, does that satisfy the traditional English restriction on being taxed without your consent, and is it really true that the colonies are represented this way? So in other words, they share in common all the same, by and large, the same theoretical and historical presuppositions, but it's the practical application of them to particular cases that yields us these various problems. Let me see. I think there might be one more question. Let's see, in that thing, I've got to go back to my window. Okay, well, that's all I've got there. I'm refreshing. Refreshing again. Okay, well, somebody recommended a couple of books. Somebody recommends an Elliot Pattison, and the title's Bone Rattler and Eye of the Raven as like, I don't know, 17th century stuff, 18th century stuff like that. Okay, let's go back to the main page here and refresh. I guess one more has popped up. See. Oh no, okay, no, that was the one that popped up, was that comment. Okay, so what's on your mind? As I say, we can talk about anything you want to. Doesn't have to be about, colonial Georgia. It could be about other things. What traditional meaning was the using was chartered colonies? I don't understand. Okay, the question, what traditional meaning was the king using when he chartered colonies? Just clarify that for me. It was clarify the term of traditional meaning. And I think I can answer that. Okay, well, in the meantime, the question that Nathaniel's asking is, I mean, well, communication was about as it was anywhere at that time. People wrote a lot of letters. We had a lot of correspondence back and forth. Like John Winthrop wrote to his wife several times a week and stuff like that. That was one of the reasons that early on some of these settlements had such difficulty attracting settlers, was that people did find out what the problems were. And so didn't want to go there. Jamestown had that problem early on. Everybody's dying. It's horrible. So people did find out that, and that's part of the reason that some places were real backwaters for a long time, and other places really flourished. I mean, Georgia flourished after the central planters went away. Pennsylvania flourished from the beginning. No surprise. I mean, why wouldn't you want to go to colonial Pennsylvania? Okay, let's see. Constitution. Oh, okay, I see what you mean. Well, yeah, okay, so when the king approves various charters, like if you look, for example, at the charter that Virginia has, the Virginians pointed to this thing over and over again. And the charter would be renewed over time, that the king would renew, would just once again acknowledge the charter as the, macro governing document. It acknowledges certain liberties of the colonists, regarding their powers of self-government and so on. So from the colonial point of view, I mean, that's all we need, is that we've got this guarantee from the king, and we go from there. Now, in the case of Virginia, I write about this a little bit in Nullification, but Jefferson and some of his followers were of the belief that Virginia in particular, since the Virginians had basically gone to the New World of their own free will, at their own expense, that basically when they got to the New World, they were thrown back into the pre-political state of nature. They were not, in fact, under the authority of the king. They voluntarily placed themselves under the authority of the king in exchange for certain guarantees regarding their powers to govern themselves. Now, I highly doubt that's the way the king thought, that his subjects, simply because they had gone to a new place, were no longer his subjects. I'm sure that's not how he thought of it, but that's how Americans thought of it. And so in a way, that's kind of what matters. What did Americans think they were doing? Because they're the ones who are going to revolt. And so I'm sure that both sides probably viewed things somewhat differently. And as I say, Jefferson's view of the nature of Virginia, I think it's hard to imagine that a king thought that's what he was doing, that he was signing approval for people to go off and leave his jurisdiction, and leave his whole bailiwick, I guess, and that their relationship with him would be one that they entered into voluntarily. I just seems very unlikely. But so in other words, the important thing is what the colony's own perception of what they were doing was. And in their perception, Well, anything that exists for a long time, any liberty that's actually exercised in practice for uninterruptedly, then becomes part of this larger body of English traditions, and their own self-government becomes that with the passage of time. So this matures over time. Okay. Oh my gosh, Floyd says that we're doing a 4-in-1 volume reprint of Conceived in Liberty. That's going to be a gigantic book. Oh my gosh, like that, I mean, that would be, that's like a weapon. Okay. Okay. Oh, all right. So can you please tell us a little bit about the monetary situation during this time period?
Well, yeah, I can. I wrote about this so long ago, and I haven't revisited it in so long, but Rothbard has a, pardon me one second, he's got a chapter on specifically this, and I am thinking it's in, no, it's not, volume 2. Just because, I mean, I'll answer, but I want to refer you to the best thing that there would be. Is that the only section he has? Page 123, volume 2. Let's just see what it covers. Okay, let's see. Yeah, I mean, this talks about... Yeah, probably the best thing to do, I mean, I'll say a few things, but is... And remember, all these books are available online at the Institute. But Volume 2 of Conceived in Liberty, it's Chapter 26, is Inflation and the Creation of Paper Money. So this is a discussion of how paper money comes to exist in the colonies. It's in colonial Massachusetts in 1690 that paper money gets started. And it's mainly started because the Massachusetts government, which enjoyed sending people on expeditions into Canada to get loot, and they needed to pay them with something, so they were just starting to print up the money. So Massachusetts that initiates this. And the policies, from what I remember, are somewhat all different around the various colonies. But typically, the hard money that's used is almost always foreign coin. It's always just coins that happen to be in circulation. I mean, partly because there was a Spanish presence, there was a French presence on the continent. So, in fact, by the time you actually get to the Constitution, the idea of the dollar, that had a specific meaning. That wasn't just an arbitrary word. They said, let's just call our currency unit the dollar. The dollar was a silver coin of a particular weight, a particular number of grains of fine silver. And it was the Spanish silver dollar. So at the time the Constitution was drafted, when they used the word dollar, they were referring back to the colonial experience where the most common money that people came into contact with, hard money, was the Spanish silver dollar. So dollar had a specific meaning when in the Constitution. And I talked a little bit about this in Kevin Gutzman and I have a chapter on the gold seizure in 1933 under FDR. And so we give a little bit of the background regarding money. And we talk about the dollar actually meaning something. So in other words, the dollar did not mean some arbitrary thing that the government is empowered to manipulate at will. That couldn't be. Because in the... Well, later on with the Bill of Rights, we have the guarantee that you can have a jury trial for cases involving more than $20. Well, okay, if the government had the power to manipulate the money at will, it could make $20 an impossibly expensive sum or a ludicrously trivial sum. No, the $20 meant 20 Spanish silver dollars. So by and large, people would use the hard money. They would use hard money that was minted typically in foreign countries. But we did also see the introduction of paper money throughout the colonies. You see it also in Pennsylvania, and you can read, if you read every issue of the Pennsylvania Gazette, which was published by Ben Franklin, is available on CD-ROM somewhere in research libraries. And if you read through those cases, you find all sorts of problems and confusion that you would expect from paper money. And you find that typically the colonists are complaining there's a shortage of money. And that's why we need to print more paper money. But the problem is that you print more paper money, and the additional paper money then leads to still higher prices. And the higher prices lead to more complaints that, oh my gosh, the prices are so high, we don't have enough money to pay to buy all the goods at these prices. We need more money. So they create more money. And that bids prices up even higher, which leads to still more complaints of a shortage of money. The shortage of money sort of thing runs through, I mean, I did a research thing where I looked through the Pennsylvania Gazette, and they're all talking about it. But by and large, it seems like it's a self-interested complaint that, you know, from people who just want a cheap money policy and they want availability of cheap loans and so on and on, really. So basically, you can find all kinds of monetary wisdom and folly. You can find people who wrote great monetary treatises, who understood the nature of inflation, and you can find paper money experiments, usually that ended in grief. And then you get to the Revolutionary War, and when we talk about that, I've already assigned the reading, I think, pertaining to the continental currency. And it got to the point where the framers of the Constitution then felt like through the colonial period and through the financing of the war for independence, they had enough experience with the fluctuations and instability caused by paper money. And yet, at the same time, they had also had adequate experience with the relative stability of hard currency, that they wanted to have a hard money society, basically. So in other words, the colonies afford you examples of both. And having seen both in action, having actually lived through both, the framers more or less felt like the testimony of American history was such that we need a hard money kind of system. Okay. What else have we got here? Do I think they agree? Do I ever think there'll be another gold confiscation like the one in 1933? Well, there could be, but now, see, the difference is that in 1933, a lot of people believed that that was only temporary, that they were going to get the gold back at some point. So therefore they were much more willing to part with it. Now, you may say they were naive or they should have known better, but, well, okay, that's easy to see in hindsight. But now that we know how that turned out, if the government turns around and says to us today, hey, we're coming to get your gold, but, you know, hey, you know, we'll give it back to you after the emergency is over, given that we already know how that story comes out, I think people are more inclined to, let's say, hand over just a portion. And the analogy I like to draw is if they came collecting guns door to door, I think people would take out, you know, like that one gun that is just very hard to maintain, keep clean, and whatever, and they, you know, they're just as well rid of anyway, and they'd say, here you go, officer, and then the guy would leave, and you'd still have your stash. And I think people would, by and large, do that with gold as well, which is, of course, part of the reason they want to keep track of gold purchases and all that, but even that is really difficult and clumsy for them. So I think in practice it would be hard for them to do. Okay, but yeah, we may know, but do Americans in general? Americans in general might not, but Americans in general probably won't hold gold. Because for the very same reason that they don't know anything about U.S. history and gold confiscation, they also don't know anything about monetary policy, the value of gold and silver, so I don't think they're going to be in that position to have this problem in the first place. Okay. Oh, okay, all right, so I missed something about a website I was putting together with book lists. Oh, okay, yeah. Actually, I'm putting together a website that's going to be like a resource for homeschoolers, but not just homeschoolers, just the general public, anybody who wants to learn U.S. history or Western Civ and a bunch of other topics from kind of like my quirky point of view, basically. It won't be like Mises Academy because I won't be directly talking to you, but it'll be a place where, nevertheless, you'd be able to find a lot of resources, interact with people, interact with me, have discussions, watch a lot of videos, You know, I mean, just all, you know, from American history from beginning to the end. Well, the end sounds kind of ominous, doesn't it? But anyway, so I'm going to be working on that, and I've got some people I've handpicked whom I trust, who, you know, who have strengths that I lack, and we're going to work together. We're going to put together a neat little site that I think will complement this, and I think it will help a lot of people. I hope it will help a lot of people. Yes, thank you very much. The Americans, the Colonial Experience. Thank you. That is the Borson book. My memory is just, I'm embarrassed at how bad it is these days. Would it cost money? Yes, but a trivial amount. I mean, it's like pennies. And I'm going to add more and more and more and more resources to it and not raise the price. So it's just going to be, like, you'll be embarrassed at how little it is. Okay. Yeah, well, you don't know what my age is. You know, nobody knows how old I am. I used to ask my students that as an extra credit question. Take your best guess what my age is. Nobody knew what the correct answer was. Do we underestimate, just to be safe? Yeah, in a way, I want to... Wait, are you guys guessing my age, or are you telling me your ages? So somebody tell... Are you telling me your ages, or are you guessing? Are you people guessing? You're guessing me. Somebody's guessing I'm 47? You're killing me here. All right, I'm 38. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Kyle. Good man. Good man, absolutely. And Rob knows. Yeah, well, in a way, I'm kind of modeling this thing after the teaching company, except for the price of 1.5 teaching company things, I'm going to have, like, 7 or 8 things. And I'm going to keep adding and adding and adding and adding and adding, and it's still going to be the same. And teaching companies kind of hit or miss. You know, if it's going to be any good, or do I trust these people? It's basically going to be me, you know, just doing my thing and whatever. So, okay. All right. Well, I guess we'll go for a few more minutes. And then I have to get ready for my next class. Yeah, teaching company is very, very conventional, mainly because they don't want to offend anybody. They want to cater to the lowest common denominator. And I don't mean that they don't have good scholars, but I mean they don't want to say anything that's going to offend half their audience. So they have to really tread carefully. Oh, thank you, Alan. It's very generous. Thank you. Okay. Anyway, all right, let's see. What else? Am I working on a new book? No. And I don't plan to for a long, long time. It's just a frustrating experience. And you know, you can't get publicity for them. You can't get them to sell. And you feel like it's a contribution, but you don't know how to tell people. I have other ways to get information out there. It's just not worth the strain on my mental health of just constantly putting stuff out. I just can't do it anymore. Okay. Let's see. Yeah, I don't think there'd be much, because rollback, like pretty much everything I know about the subjects in rollback is in rollback. So like I'm not sure I could elaborate on anything. Like pretty much that's it. This is what I know. That's right that. That's it. Okay. Yeah, you know what? I've actually never been, colonial history during the Dutch-English conflict. Well, I mean, there would be some stuff in Rothbard on that, I think. Otherwise, you just do some Amazon or Google searches. Putting the books on Amazon Kindle. Well, my recent books are all on Kindle. And if you go to tomwoods.com, click on books, you can click on the book you're interested in and see if it's on Kindle. Catholic history, for some reason, even though I wrote my dissertation on an episode in Catholic U.S. history, I'm actually not interested in American Catholic history. For some reason, even though I'm interested in church history overall, I've never been able to get interested really in that subject. What's going on with you and Levin? Well, just go to tomwoods.com, look at my recent blog post, and that will inform you what's going on. Okay, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm sort of bored with history. I don't want to put it that way, but I'm more interested in economics these days. Catholic libertarianism, yeah, but the problem is that the market for that is like 7 people. I've already written The Church of the Market, which is like 60% a book on libertarianism, really. Okay. What else? We got like 1 minute away. What's that question you're dying to ask, but you feel like it would be rude? Now everybody's afraid to ask that rude question? Okay. Thank you, Dennis. What car do I drive and radio show? And Patrick, I have no idea what you're asking me. The little one is fine. Yeah. No, I mean, look, we have four children. One of them is very, very young, but the other three are 7.5 and 6 and almost 5. And, I mean, we're constantly being told, unsolicited, how wonderful and well-behaved and polite they are. They are the sweetest. And, like, I didn't know that they made kits like these. They are unbelievable. They light up my life more than I can possibly describe to you. However, there's one of them who, when she gets a little tired, becomes just totally unreasonable and was making noise and being disruptive. And I thought, no. Like, she knows I'm in here and shouldn't be acting like that. So, I mean, I know they're just kids, you know, and they're so good that when they act like this, it just shocks me. Like, I feel like, you know, like my, you know, 5-year-old, almost 5, is like 5 going on 55. So just surprised, I have to remind myself, she is only a little kid. So, all right, how does libertarianism deal with class struggle? Well, you should read Ralph Rako on that. Ralph Rako, just Google Ralph Rako and class struggle. He's got an excellent Journal of Libertarian Studies article on that. Between individual rights and subsidiarity, which do I prefer to emphasize? Depends on the audience, because I like both principles. Depends on which one's going to resonate better with that audience. Then once I get them to come on board with that, then I bring them the whole package later. Oh, Rako, sorry, R-A-I-C-O. Look, Ralph Rako, put that in quotation marks, and then separately do a search for class analysis. So Ralph Rako, quotation marks, then right next to it, class analysis, libertarian class analysis. There's a great article on that. But going back up here, what car do I drive? Well, I'll tell you, up until last year, I drove a BMW 3 Series, okay? And I don't drive it anymore. I had it for like five years, which is like the longest I've ever had a car. I had it for 5 years. And then I actually drive a Hyundai Sonata. And it's not the fanciest car in the world, but it's super reliable. It gets fantastic mileage. I had a Sonata years and years and years and years ago, and it never gave me a moment's grief, so I like it. I bought that BMW, actually, because when the politically incorrect... Now, remember, authors do not make nearly as much money as you think they do. So however many copies of my books you think I've sold, divide that by 12, and you might be in the ballpark. And however much money you think I earn from each book, divide that by 12, and you're getting close. But nevertheless, I did well enough with that book that I thought, all right, look, I want one extravagance. Because at that time, we were living in a New York apartment fairly frugally. So I wanted one extravagance, so I got the BMW. And partly, I'm telling this to you guys because I feel like you're in my class here, and I can just be forthright and honest with you. But when I was in high school, I had a great time in high school. I had so many friends. I had a blast. I didn't want to leave high school. I didn't want to go to college. I was having so much fun in high school. It was great. But junior high was horrible. Absolutely horrible. I couldn't get along with these people. I didn't understand them. I just had nothing in common with them at all. And so people gave me a hard time because, like, I was the smart kid, so naturally you have to make him miserable. And I so resented that. I just thought, that is just so wrong. Like, I mean, I haven't done anything wrong, so why are you giving me a hard time? Anyway, so high school, that was all behind me. But for some reason, I've never really been able to get past this. So somehow, driving that car was my way of saying to these SOBs, I'm sorry if you have young people in the audience, I don't know what SOB stands for, I apologize. But driving that car was my revenge, is my way of saying, you know, you gave me a hard time, but look at what car I'm driving. And I realize how childish that is. Believe me, there's no one in this setting who realizes more than I do how infantile that is. But it gave me tremendous satisfaction. Okay. I get the same amount if you order the books from the Institute or Amazon. Doesn't matter. Yeah, I know. Isn't that awful that I'm so shallow? I'm really not. 99% of the time, I really am not. But, man, that was just terrible of them. So, okay. And somebody's asking me about a radio show. I think it's just too much work. Like, I don't know how I would ever manage it. I mean, like, because anybody can have a radio show now that you get the internet, practically. I could get an internet show tomorrow. But do you think there's a real shortage of MP3s out there for people to listen to? Are people saying, I don't have enough stuff on my iPod? I don't think there's a, I don't think there's a demand for it. And there's so much. There's so many podcasts, right? Like, how? It's just too much. There's already too much. Okay. How long have I been married? It'll be 9 years in August. Oh, that's very nice of me to say. Thanks. Interview with a Zombie DVD. Hang on a second. Look at this. Look at this. Wait, let's get out of the light. Interview with a Zombie that the designer gave me. Open it up. There's Bob's head on the disc. It exists, my friend. It's got the main thing and the bloopers. It's got photos of us on the back. Ah, you all wish you could have one of those, all you collectors out there. Okay, anyway, I gotta run. I gotta go into my other class now. So, actually, Kevin Gutzman. Some of you might know him, Kevin Gutzman. Great guy, good friend of mine. He was saying just today. He texted me just today to say. And I know that Danny's going crazy. Will you get off of here? Get on your other class? I know. I'm just about to. But here's Kevin. Gosh, why are my messages taking so long to come out? Oh, that's from Jack Hunter telling me about Mark Levin smearing us. Okay. Let's get Kevin up here. Yeah. So Kevin writes to me today and says, well, you can't see this, obviously, but he says, you and I should have a radio show. He says, we could route these people, and then in all caps, every day. All right. Okay, good. All right, thank you very much. I'll probably teach this one again over the summer, and I don't know what my other plans are. I can't think that far ahead right now. Have to see how busy I am. All right. Thank you guys very much. Have a good night. We'll see you in a week, and I'll get those questions up for you tomorrow, and you'll have longer than you did in the past for them. All right. Good night. We have a lot of fun next week. We'll chit-chat about John Locke and lots of fun people. Okay, good night.